You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Rochester, New York, by way of Atlanta, please give it up for Amir Suleiman.
I am not angry. I am anger. I am not dangerous. I am danger. I am abominable stress, idiotic, relentless. I'm a breath of vengeance. I'm a death sentence. I'm forsaken repentance to the beast and his henchmen, armed forces and policemen that survive off of oil and prisons of today. Cup one is over with lost souls that wear oversized caps like blindfolds, shiny necklaces like lassos, dragging them into black holes. And I may have to holler at Fidel Castro to get my other brothers out of Guantanamo. And the innocents on death row is probably in the same proportion as the criminals in black robes that smack gavels that crack domes, that smack gavels that smash homes. Justice is somewhere in between reading sad poems and 40 ounces of gasoline crashing through windows. It is between plans and action. It is between writing letters to congressmen and clapping the captain. It is between raising legal defense funds and put a gun on the bailiff and taking the judge captive. It is between prayer and fasting, between burning and blasting. Freedom is between the mind and the soul, between a lock and the load, between the zeal of the young and the patience of the old. Freedom is between the finger and the trigger. It is between the page and the pen. It is between the grenade and the pen. Between righteous anger, keep it one in the chamber. So what can they do with a cat with a heart like Turner, a mind like Douglas, a mouth like Malcolm, and a voice like Chris? That is why I am not dangerous, I am danger. I am not angry, I am anger. I am abominable stress, idiotic, relentless. I'm a death sentence to the beast and his henchmen, politicians and big businessmen. I'm a teenage Palestinian opening fire at an Israeli checkpoint, point blank, checkmate, now what? I'm a rape victim with a gun cocked to his cock, cock, bang, bang, cock, now what? I am Sitting Bull with Colonel Custer's scalp in my hands. I am Sin K with a slave treaded blood on my hands. I am Jonathan Jackson handing a gun to my man. I am David with a slingshot and a rock. And if David lived today, he'd have a Molotov cocktail and a Glock. So down with Goliath, I say down with Goliath, but we must learn, no, right, read, we must kick, bite, yell, scream, we must pray, fast, live, dream, fight, kill, and die free.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and over the last, well, first of all, I should say that was Amir Suleiman with his spoken word poem Danger on death poetry in the United States. That was, like, I think he did that one like in 2008 or something like that. It was a while ago, but I mean, he's an amazing poet. So that's why I've actually played some of his pieces over the last few weeks. But anyway, what the subject of today's show is something that doesn't get talked about nearly enough. And that, of course, is the concept of justice. And specifically the concept of justice as it relates to socialism. Now, as you know, on the show over the last while, you know, over the last, like, basically it's been going on for almost 2 months now, I've been talking about my book, Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future, and going through the different chapters and all the different concepts that I deal with and this sort of thing. And the concept of socialist justice is a very integral part of the book, which I've written. And to listen to mainstream anti-communist commentators speak, when they even bother to speak about this kind of thing at all, there was an, like, to listen to them, like, they basically say there was and is no such thing as justice in socialist countries. You know, they say there was only brutal repression and unaccountable power. And of course, we're never given any real information about socialist courts, legal systems, judicial bodies, law codes, methods of rehabilitation, and so on. You know, we're told that socialist societies only functioned because everyone had a gun to their head or some such nonsense. But chapter 10 of Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future, deals with judicial authority in a socialist society. It deals with justice in a socialist society. And the concept of proletarian justice, because one of the most crucial things to understand about law, legal systems, and law enforcement, regardless of where it is, under regardless of what society we're talking about, it's all based on class power. And who the ruling class is in the society and its interests. Law is always made and enforced in the interests of the ruling class of society. And this is why feudal lords in 18th century France could often get away with murdering someone from the lower classes by explaining that they were defending their honor. You know, as aristocrats, as members of the ruling class, some such thing. And why modern American capitalists can often completely escape punishment. Even when they commit the biggest financial crimes in all of human history. You know, to the point of even receiving billions of dollars in public money to bail out their corporate holdings. You know, and I actually want to quote Michael Parenti in his book, Democracy for the Few. He has a section, well, he has a chapter called Unequal Before the Law. And of course, he's talking specifically about the United States, but it could easily be applied to Canada or other capitalist countries. He has a short section called Class Law, and this is what it says. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black once noted that there can be, quote, can be no equal justice where the kind of trial a man gets depends on the amount of money he has, end quote. Whether the legal system treats a person as prince or pariah rests largely on one's financial resources. The corporate executive with deep pockets and a team of high-powered attorneys experiences different treatment from the law than the poor person with an underpaid court-appointed lawyer who sees the defendant for the first time on the day of the trial. Poor and working-class persons, the uneducated, the members of racial minorities, are more likely to be arrested, denied bail, induced to plead guilty, and do without a pretrial hearing or adequate representation. They are less likely to have a jury trial, if tried, more likely to be convicted, and receive a harsh sentence, including the death penalty. Less able to launch extended appeals and less likely to receive probation or a suspended sentence than are mobsters, business executives, and more affluent people in general. As has been said, the rich have little reason to fear the legal system and the poor have little reason to respect it. And actually, there's a comrade of mine in Hamilton, in the Young Communist League, he's a very smart guy. I mean, he went to law school. He went through the entire process, basically has like legal training and all that kind of stuff. He's been in many, many courtrooms. And he sees this kind of stuff all the time. You know, virtually everybody who gets hauled before a judge, you know, they're always like, they're poor. Many of them have addictions. You know, many of them don't have jobs. Many of them, you know, are basically down and out. They don't have any recourse. You know, adequate legal representation, and they're just, you know, basically railroaded. You know, this is the kind of people who are basically going through the legal system overwhelmingly in capitalist societies. It's working class people. You know, and you get the most depressing stories ever. You know, people who've been dragged through the mud and basically never had a chance. You know, but Michael Parenti goes on, he says, working people engaged in labor struggles have cause for complaint. In recent years, police have attacked striking farm laborers, truckers, miners, meat packers, janitors, and factory and construction workers, arresting and injuring hundreds. Private security forces beat up striking workers and break picket lines with acts of violence that go unchallenged by police and prosecutors. Workers have been imprisoned for resisting court injunctions against strikes and pickets, and even for shouting at scab workers or daring to talk back to police while on picket lines. In Elmwood, Indiana, 7 strikers were shot by company goons. A striking coal miner in Harlan County, Kentucky, was shot dead by a gun thug, as was another miner in McDowell County, West Virginia, and a farm worker in Texas. In none of these cases did police apprehend anyone, despite eyewitness evidence to the identity of the killers. You know, and these weren't like, this wasn't ancient history. I mean, these are all examples from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, basically. You know. So the law always reflects ruling class interests. And since the working class is the ruling class in socialist society, socialist justice must reflect proletarian class interests. Socialist law is working class law, and as such, it is no surprise at all that it would be hated, loathed, and considered illegitimate, entirely illegitimate, by the capitalist class and its carefully chosen spokespeople. Because justice for proletarians means the revolutionary destruction of all systems of exploitation and class oppression in society. All systems that reduce human beings to the status of objects and commodities. The same systems that capitalists rely on for their power and wealth. As the great African revolutionary Thomas Sankara stressed in a speech concerning the establishment of the system of People's Revolutionary Courts in Burkina Faso in January 1984, real justice has a class character, and the traditionally exploited working class must be empowered to impose their justice on their exploiters. In Sankara's words, to all the criminals who have always scorned and humiliated the people by inflicting 1,001 indignities.
$30 million, claiming it's just a drug bust.
They thinking they're making a fly switch, the break the double for the witch.
Reach, somebody reach, gotta reach. Power to the people and the beats. Some people are cute, some people are prime, some people get away with losing my rhyme. They don't like where I'm coming from, so they play dumb. Dumb diggity dumb, diggity dumb. Well, I'm telling you what they do. Everybody plays a fool while the real people cools in a pool.
Yeah.
He got the finger on the war button. Talking loud, ain't saying nothing. TV got him bigger than life. All he needs is a knife. Who the criminal? Blind, deaf, and dumb. Hard to see them coming, but they come. Here they come. Don't be dumb, thinkity dumb. Politicking right back checks. Still ain't getting wrecked. Going for a knick-knack. Rolling in a blue and white gang. 32 bang, biggity bang. Hanging around the hanging rope.
Nope,
nope, nope. N-O-P-E. I ain't been it for the soap.
Yeah.
Never understood why the hood half a who's in the joint. Now they got me losing my point. Gotta have it going on. Born criminal, born. Take a piece of America back. But who had it first? Hear the Indian curse. Robbed and stole so many, so much it ain't funny. Now I got them face on money. Politicians passing up bill, paid in full. See no rocking in the pocket, how they living. Making sure they locking us up. I got a feeling I'm. When it comes to something we say, what they don't like is a brother like me on the mic. In fact, to the gritty ain't none of us whack. Noriega head back.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Dahmer, it's just a room without cuffs. How the hell do we get stuffed in the back of a cell on the aisle? Ain't it wild? What's criminal? Power to the people in the beats. One more. Time to kick the rhythm and keep a ripping down the door. So the real criminals get exposed behind the clothes. Doors in the suits that make and break the law. Looking for my own cause I had enough fools. I can understand it. Must been the crooked way they planned. Police supposed to keep the peace. But I can't trust them, so I keep my peace. Loaded in cock cause I don't miss the flock. Talk about the ones who don't get chained to the rock.
Yeah.
Those that got away with the dirt and the grime. While we go away from the neighborhood crime. Never like what I saw in the law. Indiana trees hanging us instead of leaves.
Yeah.
We hanging from the rope.
Yeah.
By real criminals.
They thinking they're making the black switch. The place is double for the win. Dirty.
Reach up and you reach, gotta reach. Power to the people and the beats.
Yeah.
Reach up and reach, gotta reach. Power to the people in the.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Public Enemy with Hazy Shade of Criminal. And the list of criminals that the law and capitalist society protects, and there's the operative word, protects, is very, very long indeed. They were talking about like the imperialists and murderers who staff the CIA and the Pentagon, you know, responsible for the deaths of literally millions of people in places like Iraq, Yugoslavia, Libya, Syria, you know, and many, many others. Like, especially if you want to go back all the way to the Second World War, the end of, back to like basically when the national security state in the United States was founded. You know, the amount of crimes that the enforcers of capitalism have committed around the world is staggering. And but of course, you could also say the people who staff the IMF, the people who are in the World Bank, the people who are in the Fortune 500. In the various multinational corporations and the kind of things they do around the world, whether that's like environmental devastation, whether that's like the, paying starvation wages, whether that's, breaking labor unions and using terror tactics, police terror against them, private security forces against working people trying to organize, or any of these things. You know, charging of crushing rents on tenants, austerity measures, you name it. All these things are criminal acts perpetrated against working people, against proletarians. And this goes on all the time, it's considered normal, it's considered legal. And that's nothing short of monstrous. Now, socialist society, by contrast, is founded on the principle of self-determination for working class people, not founded on the profit motive and ensuring that the property and profits of capitalists and are secure. It's not based on that. It's founded on the principle of self-determination for working class people, something that capitalism and all systems of class exploitation deny. And this is the fundamental crime of capitalism, and this is why the laws of the Soviet Union, as the world's first socialist state, placed an effective ban on the profit motive. Soviet citizens were not allowed to exploit the labor of another person for economic gain. You know, they weren't allowed to employ someone and exploit that person for their profit. And to us, that sounds very, very strange because we're so used to, like, you know, in that whole relationship, you know, of owner and employee. You know, it seems very natural to us. But over there, that was outlawed. In fact, most socialist states, that traditionally has been outlawed. Soviet citizens were also not allowed to charge rents. They weren't allowed to rent out property. You know, and exploit someone, you know, who was just looking for a roof over their head and, you know, and making them pay, you know, big money to them, charging them to, like, have a place to stay. They're not allowed to do that. They weren't allowed to engage in financial speculation or in profiteering of any kind. That was against the law. Even today in China, this kind of activity is, you know, and of course we hear about China and like a lot of people think that, oh yeah, China isn't even socialist anymore. But actually this kind of stuff, you know, the Communist Party is still in power in China. Like, you know, half the economy is still in the public domain, state run. And the socialist state is still very much in control. And this kind of activity, you know, like charging rents, financial speculation, profiteering, all this sort of stuff, that is heavily regulated in China. And those who break those regulations face severe penalties, which is very much in contrast with the situation in places like the United States and Canada. In a socialist society, exploitation is effectively criminalized. with the understanding that liberation for working class people demands the criminalization of those forces that have historically abused working people. And really, it was the increasingly lax enforcement of laws against exploitation, culminating with the outright legalization of the black market in 1988 by Mikhail Gorbachev. It was that that played a major role in the USSR's downfall, as it allowed a new class of capitalists to come into being. Now, the justice system of the Universal Republic, the socialist federation that I describe in my book, Proletarian God, will be based on the criminalization of exploitation, with the understanding that it is essential for the survival of the socialist state itself, you know, to outlaw the profit motive. It's something that cannot be, the socialist state cannot be lax in enforcing. The judicial branch of government in the Universal Republic will be called the Judicator Order and will function as a second revolutionary vanguard made up of men and women who have dedicated their lives to the pursuit of socialist justice. Like the Universalist Order, and that's what I talked about in the last show, and the executive branch of government, the Judicator's Order's members will be drawn from the first echelon volunteers of the Proletarian Guard and will remain accountable to the Guard and the legislative branch of government. Judicators are essentially judges, and they will have authority over judicial officials, legal representatives, and police officers, all of whom must also be members of first echelon, thus having volunteered to dedicate their lives to the socialist cause, which really is what first echelon is all about. I've described that in past shows. The judicial branch will be organized along the same lines as the executive and will likewise function at all levels of the Universal Republic, from the local to the global. The judicator order's legal authority will be universal in scope, and this is crucial. Given the globalized nature of capitalism and the globalized abuse it inflicts on humanity, the crimes of capitalism are of an international nature, thus demanding that socialist legal authorities have universal jurisdiction in order to prosecute the international, or perhaps a better term would be multinational, criminals who carry out these crimes. One is reminded of Maximilien Robespierre's comment concerning the execution of King Louis XVI of France in 1792. He said, quote, "The despot's trial is the insurrection, the verdict, the collapse of his power, the sentence, whatever the liberty of the people requires. Bringing down the exploiters and oppressors of the world is a revolutionary act, and their trial and sentencing are vital aspects of the revolutionary process of class overthrow." The judges of the socialist state must have the power to condemn the oppressors of the proletariat wherever they may be found. Their justice must know no borders. And considering they would be prosecuting criminals such as those who engage in, you know, basically imperialists, multinational capitalists, those whose crimes literally are globalized. They commit crimes, they exploit working people in every quarter of the globe. So socialist legal authorities have to have the power to prosecute those criminals, wherever they may be. And please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was actually the Civilization 4, Sid Meier's Civilization 4 Beyond the Sword theme, if anybody remembers that that particular game from several years ago. But certainly I thought it suitable to, as a song, to represent a judicial force, a socialist judicial force with a jurisdiction that is universal, with the power to prosecute basically capitalism and the criminals who benefit from capitalism anywhere where they may be. They're basically prosecuting a criminal system throughout the world, and they're therefore an integral part in bringing it down and bringing that system down. You know, revolutionary justice is very central, very crucial to revolution itself. You know, making sure that the oppressors of the people, the exploiters of the people, pay for their crimes. And that was the case. You know, that process was very crucial in the Chinese Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the Cuban Revolution. There were many, many trials after these revolutions happened. Like those members of the ruling class who did not get away, who did not go into exile, those who were caught by revolutionary forces were put on trial, and they did answer for their crimes. Now, as I've mentioned before, policing in the Universal Republic, and I talked about to some extent in the section which I did on the Proletarian Guard, which of course is the legislative branch of the Universal Republic. Policing in the Universal Republic is largely the responsibility of the people themselves. You know, very, very different from the way it is in capitalist society, where, you know, you always have this professional police, which is, you know, not only engages in criminal investigation, but also is engaged, you know, maintains public order. You know, to the point of using very brutal tactics in many cases. When someone becomes a full citizen in the Universal Republic and joins the Proletarian Guard, because as you know, as I talked about before, joining the Proletarian Guard is the initiation into adulthood in the socialist society I'm talking about here. You know, from the ages of 18 to age 20 approximately, people will go through the process of training to become a citizen, basically. 2 years. And they will be given training in policing, as well as in military first aid and firefighting. Now, professional police, those who have actually chosen to dedicate, you know, their professional lives to policing, they will function as criminal investigators rather than enforcers of public order, and will therefore have a much more limited role in society. The Cuban people, through the local committees for the defense of the revolution, largely police their own neighborhoods even now. You know, that's a reality in their socialist society. Under socialism, and this is crucial, we do not want law enforcement to function as an outside force, an external force, capable of swooping into neighborhoods and destroying the lives of individuals and families at will, which is the reality throughout the capitalist world, especially when the dynamic of racial oppression comes into play, as it does all the time in countries like the United States, where working-class African-Americans are killed every day by the police. You know, and this is something that Huey P. Newton, like the founder of the Black Panther Party, he talks about a lot in his book Revolutionary Suicide. He talks about how the police are this external force, this foreign occupying army in black communities, and they will come in and they will, you know, basically, you know, abuse, arrest, kill, you know, whoever, and they basically have impunity. You know, and of course, they're not like from those neighborhoods. There's this external force which comes in, you know, and swoops down and does all these things to people. You know, that's what we don't want. You know, that absolutely is unacceptable. You know, policing really has to be done by the people themselves, in their own communities. Lenin's statement that, quote, only an armed people can serve as a real bulwark of popular liberty, applies as much to law enforcement as it does to military affairs and national defense. And the last thing I really want to get into in this discussion of socialist justice is the matter of legal punishment and the rehabilitation of criminals. Once again, anti-communists would have you believe that socialist societies would just shoot anyone suspected of a crime, and that rehabilitation would consist of either slave labor or a bullet in the back of the head. Needless to say, this is not the case. Huey P. Newton said that when people can, quote, can be motivated to believe that they have something to offer society, something desperately needed, which only they can contribute, then there will be no need for prisons. Each man must first be convinced of his own value and uniqueness, and that his uniqueness is his, and his only, to give to others. That is what true rehabilitation means. And in the Soviet Union and other 20th century socialist societies, criminologists widely understood this truth of what Huey P. Newton was talking about, and recognized the need to focus on the structural causes of crime within society rather than on the punishment of individuals. A great example, even during the rural crisis of 1930 and 1931, in which the Soviet state mobilized the masses of the peasantry to take over the private holdings of the rural landowners, and the landowners responded with a campaign of violence, assassinations, and economic sabotage that brought whole regions to the brink of famine, executions were still rare. You know, this is a time in the early 1930s when, of course, like, there was the collectivization of agriculture in the Soviet Union. You know, so they were going in there and they were taking the private land holdings of rich peasants, kulaks, and then basically nationalizing them, you know, turning them into state farms that would be run by agricultural workers. Even during this time of great upheaval, you know, at a time when, like, the landowners were, like, you know, using immense violence to try to hold on to what they had. You know, even killing members of the Communist Party and, like, engaging in, you know, assassinations, burning crops, you know, burning buildings down, like, burning, destroying farm equipment, you know, engaging in all kinds of sabotage. The Soviet state still did not engage in judicial violence. The Soviet state was not interested in killing the kulak landowners, but in removing their ability to exploit the peasantry and removing their ability to control the rural economy. And then rehabilitating them and reintegrating them into society as ordinary working people. The elimination of the kulaks as a class, often misinterpreted by Western scholars and misrepresented by Western scholars as nothing less than a call for genocide, actually meant the expropriation of the means of production that allows rich peasants to live by the exploitation of the labor power of rural proletarians and the re-education through physical labor accompanied by socialist education. You know, this is a process that these people went through. Basically, the whole idea was to get them to no longer think of themselves as owners, you know, as people who employ and exploit other people for their own gain, and get them to start thinking of themselves as proletarians, as like members of society, as members of this greater whole of working people. That they can contribute to through their own labor on equal terms. And the same approach was used with regard to lawbreakers throughout the Soviet period, as well as in China and Vietnam and Cuba and other countries, and it was both humane and largely effective. Offenders were generally treated well, generally received payment for the work that they did when they were in prison or in you were in a work camp or any sort of like any sort of judicial supervision. And they were generally able to resume their old jobs when their typically brief sentence had been served. Sophia Elijah, executive director of the Correctional Association of New York, was surprised when she visited a number of Cuban prisons in the late 1980s and didn't see any of the, quote, high stone walls, lots of barbed wire guard towers and guards with assault weapons that are features of prisons in capitalist America. The men's prison she visited looked more like a school than a prison. And just as was the case in the women's prison that she visited, no one wore prison uniforms. Prisoners had the option of engaging in work, for which they would be paid, and which would also lead to a reduced sentence. And all prisoners had the right to at least one weekend-long furlough a month to visit family. As Elijah remarked, that in Cuba, quote, you don't have this demonization and stereotyping that we have here in America, where incarcerated people are so ostracized they're like untouchables. Really, there can be no justice in a society without popular empowerment, and popular empowerment must be the means and the goal of justice in the Universal Republic and any socialist society, any future socialist society. As Thomas Sankara recognized, such empowerment is what leads to redemption in even the most hardened criminal. And he said, let's educate through democratic discussion those we're punishing. The best redemption is a process you undertake yourself, not something that comes from others. It means recognizing your errors and solemnly pledging never to repeat them. It also means every day living the life of a revolutionary who has recognized his errors. That's Thomas Sankara. The convict must serve their sentence in the knowledge that there is a community waiting to receive them when they rejoin society, and a community around them that reminds them every day that they are not alone, and that they are dignified human beings, not monsters, not untouchables. In the Soviet Union, and many other socialist countries in the past, criminals were often assigned compulsory labor jobs combined with social re-education instead of being sent to prison. It was an alternative to prison. You know, so they would go and do this work for a time. They'd be on this work detail for a time. And that would basically be their sentence. You know, they would never even set foot in a prison. So that they could contribute to society and learn from society instead of being a drain on it. Real justice can only be achieved through systemic change, the restructuring of society, the revolutionary restructuring of society, working class control over the state and the means of production, and the elimination of exploitation in all its forms. This is what Charles R. Gary, the lawyer who defended Huey P. Newton when he was on trial in the 1960s against a racist capitalist legal system of entrapment in America. This is what Charles Gary stressed when he said that the answer is not to put Huey Newton in the gas chamber. It is not the answer to put Huey Newton and his organization into jail. The answer is not more police. The answer is to wipe out the ghetto, the conditions of the ghetto, so that black brothers and sisters can live with dignity, so that they can walk down the street with dignity. And this is the justice that the Soviet Union practiced when it eliminated places like the St. Petersburg Haymarket and Moscow's Khitrovka and other inhuman slums that had been devouring human lives in cities across Russia during the days of the Tsars. And when the Soviet Union put power into the hands of the worker, while breaking the power of the exploiter. You know, and allowed working people to develop themselves, to go to school, to, you know, get an education, to, like, you know, have security in their life. Have a job that paid them a living wage, have a guaranteed income, guaranteed right to a home, to health care, to be able to develop themselves as human beings, to have access to culture. You know, not have culture being priced out of reach so they couldn't get access to it. You know, that was like, you know, periodicals or newspapers or books or, you know, concerts or museums or what have you. All that stuff was like, well, was open to everyone in the Soviet Union. Everybody could afford it. Socialist justice really means putting power into the hands of working people. And that justice serving the interests of working class people. Socialist justice equals working class power. And this will be the fundamental goal of the justice system of the Universal Republic under the leadership of the Judicator Order. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Back in the USSR, we'll be back after this short break.
My name's Peter, and I'm on CFRU, and
you can be too.
SappyFest 11 Republic of SappyFest takes over the town of Sackville, New Brunswick from July 29 to the 31st. Over 35 nationally acclaimed artists will appear at SappyFest 11, such as Bart, Chocolat, Fake Palms, Hooded Fang, Jay Arner, Dark for Dark, Little Scream, The Dirty Nil, and Les Hostess de l'Air. Full weekend passes are available for $100, taxes and fees included. For tickets and accessibility info, visit sappyfest.com.
Êtes-vous francophone ou francophile?
CFRU is looking for French-speaking volunteers to start or contribute to French language programming on the station. Le genre du programme est à vous. Que ce soit sur les actualités, la justice sociale ou les arts, la meilleure émission sera sur un sujet dont vous êtes passionné. Nous offrons la formation gratuite en technologie et production des médias.
Envoyez un message avec votre nom et coordonnées à Brian par courriel à polylingual@commercialcfru.ca pour devenir bénévole dans cette nouvelle radio collective. Apportez votre voix à CFRU 93.3 FM, la radio communautaire de Guelph.
A familiar sound of summer. It's also a warning for kids to stay away. Every year, the War Amps enrolls children who are amputees due to lawnmower accidents. Like Roan. He fell off a riding lawnmower and the blade severed his leg.
Hey, I'm Roan. I'm a safety ambassador and I have a message for all kids. Don't let it happen to you. Spot the danger before you play. Play safe!
Learn more at waramps.ca.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. And just before the break, we heard Killing Joke with their song In Excelsis, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to play another just another song, and then we're going to get into a talk by Michael Parenti, which really kind of deals with some of the subjects which I talked about here in terms of justice, and really talking about class and really who controls the power, you know, the positions of power in capitalist society, and really illustrating that, how that all works. But first, we're going to play Lee Reed with Bazooka Rap. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. Sorry about that. We seem to be having some technical issues there. I think we're just going to move straight to the talk by Michael Parenti. Just give me 1 second to just get to it. Yeah, we're having a few issues here, but we shall overcome. So we're going to get into this one. This one is actually talking about his experience with academic freedom. But at the same time, like, he's not just talking about academia. You know, and going up against the, you could say, the status quo in academia and the capitalist establishment in academia. He really goes into many other aspects of capitalist society and what it's like to actually challenge these structures, these institutions, which many people take for granted. So I'm going to play this. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Good afternoon. My name is Will Miller from the philosophy department. I'm standing in for Brian Perkins to do introductions this afternoon, and I guess I'd like to perform some of my role as local historian. I came here in 1969 as a new member of the faculty. Michael Parenti, our speaker today, arrived in 1970 after having been a visiting member of the political science department at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. In the spring of 1970, which, to put it in historical context, was the spring of the Kent State and Jackson State massacres at the height of the anti-war movement in the United States. Michael Parenti, then on the faculty at the University of Illinois, attempted to stop a garbage truck from being backed over a number of students who were engaged in a sit-in at the university at the time. For his efforts, he was assaulted by a member of the local police force in Champaign-Urbana, who was...
Three.
All of whom were wearing riot gear, face masks, shields, helmets.
Oh, I apologize for this. We're having some technical problems here. I'm going to try this again to see if this this file works, and if not, we're going to have to move on to something else. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Good afternoon. My name is Will Miller from the Philosophy Department. I'm standing in for Brian Perkins to do introductions this afternoon, and I guess I'd like to perform some of my role as local historian. I came here in 1969 as a new member of the faculty. Michael Parenti, our speaker today, arrived in 1970 after having been a visiting member of the Political Science Department at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. In the spring of 1970, which, to put it in historical context, was the spring of the Kent State and Jackson State massacres at the height of the anti-war movement in the United States, Michael Parenti, then on the faculty at the University of Illinois, attempted to stop a garbage truck from being backed over a number of students who were engaged in a sit-in at the university at the time. For his efforts, he was assaulted by a member of the local police force in Champaign-Urbana, who was...
Three.
All of whom were wearing riot gear, face masks, shields, helmets. One to not renew Michael Parenti. The reasons, however, the precedent was broken. The trustees reached down the spring of the Kent State and Jackson State massacres.
All of humanity can be divided into group A, B, and C. Group A is made up of those people who live principally off stock dividends, interest payments on their bond investments, royalties on their land and mineral holdings.
I really want to apologize for this, folks. We're having like some pretty significant technical problems. I'm going to have to restart the computer right now, given the problems that we're having. So there really isn't much else to do except talk for a while, which is kind of unfortunate. I wasn't quite prepared for this. I have to say, though, it has been rather interesting working on this book and really kind of coming to the point where I've really completed this book, which I've been talking about the last several weeks, Proletarian God, Building the Socialist Future. Because, well, one of the things that, let's say, this subject matter, this, we're actually talking about socialism, and not like in the sense of, okay, we need a more just or more equitable society in the abstract or anything like this. Actually talking about how to change society and what a future socialist society might look like. That is something that doesn't usually happen. You know, there really isn't like too many books out that really deal with what, in concrete terms, this sort of society, this sort of social construct should really look like. And really, that's the kind of task I've taken on with this book. And it's difficult. You know, it's been a difficult task. It's taken a very long time, and it's gone through many incarnations, for that matter, before it's finally reached the final form that it ultimately has. And ultimately, 422 pages. I mean, it's a pretty significant size, this book. Now, getting an actual publisher for this book, I'm really not 100% sure, and I think I might have mentioned this before, how exactly that's going to work, seeing that basically,